our discussion of black holes. And what I want to do first, I want to, well, I'll spend some time describing the sort of well-known solutions to the field equations that describe black holes. So I'll do a review of Schwarzschild. Then I think I'll say a few things about Reisner Nordström, which is the charged black hole. I'll say a few things about Kerr. My main ambition is to go away from the specific solutions to some very general statements that can be made about black holes that do not require detailed knowledge of the metric. There's a whole body of work that was developed in the 70s about black hole physics, which is really largely insensitive to the metrics and can be formulated in terms of more sort of primitive ideas about Killing symmetries and things like that. So I'll do that next, so you know, that'll be next week. And the main goal is to eventually formulate the laws of black hole mechanics. There are four of them. I'll discuss probably three of them in some detail. And the third one, well, it starts at zero, and then one, two, three. The third one I won't probably talk about much. And there, I think the nice thing is that everything that we've learned, starting from congruences to hypersurfaces to notions of mass and angular momentum, all of that will come together. And the culmination of all of that will be, you know, this ability that we'll have at formulating the laws of black hole mechanics. So this is where we're going with this. And I'll get started by talking about the simplest black hole solution, which is, of course, the Schwarzschild black hole. So, well, we've played with Schwarzschild for, you know, a number of times, so I, you know, I assume that the solution is known. I'll say a few things about it, you know, just to review a few things, but I don't think there'll be much of a need to spend a lot of time about the Schwarzschild solution. So let me just remind you of the metrics. So in the conventional Schwarzschild coordinates, we have a solution to the Einstein field equations, which is spherically symmetric. And we have one relevant metric function, which is given in terms of the mass of the black hole as follows. And there are two really important facts about the Schwarzschild metric, which are, you know, named after people. I mean, there's a first observation that says, you know, that's known as Birkhoff's theorem, which says that if you're in vacuum, if you have spherical symmetry, and if you want to construct a solution to the Einstein field equations that has those properties, then it must be a Schwarzschild metric. So the requirement that you have a solution to the field equations, the vacuum field equations, with spherical symmetry guarantees that the solution must be Schwarzschild. So what this means physically is that, well, you may have a spherically symmetric distribution of mass. It doesn't matter what it is. If you're outside of it in the vacuum region outside, then the spacetime outside that mass, however, you know, whatever the details of the mass distribution inside, you know, the vacuum region outside must be, you know, must be a part of the spacetime, must be a part of the Schwarzschild spacetime. And one thing that's very important about this is that I don't care about whether or not the spherically symmetric mass distribution inside is time dependent or not. I could have a pulsating mass, you know, going back and forth, preserving the spherical symmetry, but, you know, oscillating back and forth, you know, in a time-dependent way, the vacuum outside will not be aware of the time dependence. The vacuum outside will be a piece of the Schwarzschild spacetime. And essentially, the physical idea with that is that, well, there are no spherical gravitational waves. In order to produce a time dependence in the vacuum outside, you would have to violate the spherical symmetry inside. You know, gravitational waves have to be generated with, you know, asymmetrical situations. A spherical symmetry, a spherically symmetric mass distribution will not produce gravitational waves. So that's a very important theorem, and essentially it says that, you know, provided that you have spherical symmetry, whatever, you know, the vacuum outside, the vacuum region outside, has to be a Schwarzschild solution. This can be extended to the sitter space. So, you know, if you have a spherically symmetric mass distribution and you have a non-zero cosmological constant, then Birkhoff's theorem would say, or the extension of Birkhoff's theorem would say that you would get, you know, the Schwarzschild de Sitter solution, which is this plus a term involving the cosmological constant. There's another even more amazing theorem that's due to Israel. It's called the Israel uniqueness theorem. And that theorem says this. If you have, if you satisfy the field equations and you're in vacuum, and if you have a static spacetime, and by static here I means that there are no time-dependent processes outside, you know, in the spacetime, but more than that, that would define a stationary spacetime. The metric cannot depend on time, but more than that, it has to be true also that the metric must be invariant under time reversals. So static means both time independent and the metric itself is invariant on the time reversals. A more technical way of expressing this is to say that the killing vector, the time-like killing vector that you have if you have a stationary spacetime must be hypersurface orthogonal. And if you have both conditions, you have a static spacetime, and essentially that's a way of ruling out rotating spacetimes, because a rotating spacetime on the time reversal will rotate in the opposite direction. So you go from a, you know, right-handed rule to a left-handed rule, or, you know, the opposite convention. And essentially I'm talking here about static spacetimes, therefore no time dependence, but also no rotation. If I have vacuum and I have a static spacetime and I have an event horizon, under those conditions, the only possible solution to the field equations you can have is the Schwarzschild metric. So the statement is this. If you have all of those conditions, and notice that I'm not making a requirement about spherical symmetry, if I'm only demanding a vacuum solution, you know, with a killing symmetry, which corresponds to a static spacetime, and I put in the requirement of having a smooth event horizon, then the theorem says that this spacetime must be spherically symmetric, and therefore must be Schwarzschild. And the point here is that all black holes that are non-rotating, by virtue of this theorem, by virtue of the fact that they eventually settle down to a static state, all black holes must be Schwarzschild black holes. All non-rotating black holes must be Schwarzschild black holes. You don't assume spherical symmetry. Spherical symmetry is a result. It's the result of the Israel uniqueness theorem. And that's an amazing result that at the time it was proved back in the late 60s, no one had ever expected. I mean, there were some hints if you look carefully in the literature, but there were no hints that something so strong could ever be stated about black hole solutions. And at first it created a little bit of, you know, misunderstanding. So one interpretation of this is to say that the black hole state has to be extremely special. You could have a non-rotating star that collapses to form a black hole, and that, you know, that initial progenitor could be perfectly spherically symmetric, and if it collapses in a way that doesn't destroy the spherical symmetry, you will produce a spherically symmetric black hole. Well, you know, I said many times in that sentence the word spherical symmetry. If you arrange for spherical symmetry and maintain it every step of the way, yes, of course, you'll produce a spherically symmetric black hole. That doesn't seem surprising, but that seems awfully special. So if you prepare a progenitor that is static, non-rotating, but is far away from spherical symmetry, for example, it could have a big bump on it, it could have a mountain, it could have, you know, it could be shaped like a cube, it could be anything, you know, that the statement is that this will collapse. And because at the end of the collapse, you will have a static situation and a non-rotating situation, the final black hole will not be aware, will not retain any memory of the initial deformation of the progenitor, and the final black hole state will have perfect spherical symmetry. So it took a while for people to understand the mechanism for that to happen. Essentially, the mechanism is just the radiation of gravitational waves. You know, if you have your bumpy star that starts to collapse, you know, the perturbation away from spherical symmetry during the collapse becomes dynamical. It has a lot, you know, it's not symmetrical. It produces a lot of gravitational radiation. And in the course of the collapse, that gravitational radiation allows the collapsing body to settle down into a perfectly smooth spherical Schwarzschild black hole. And that is essentially the physical content of the Israel theorem. So yes, black hole states are very special. They just happen to occur as a result of dynamical gravitational collapse. They will achieve that state dynamically. So there's a, you know, there's a similar statement that can be made for the Kerr black hole. I'll come to that later. But essentially, even if you allow for rotation, the final black hole state is still very special. The final black hole, after everything is settled down, will be a Kerr black hole, no matter how, you know, no matter what the starting point was, no matter what your progenitor was before it collapsed to form a black hole. So, very important statements about black hole solutions. You know, Schwarzschild came up with a solution in 1916. The understanding of this as a black hole solution emerged only about 40 years later, in the late 50s. And the nature of R equals 2m was misunderstood for a long time before it finally became understood by relativists and other physicists. And it's kind of strange that it took that long, given how trivial those issues are, you know, looking in hindsight. The point is that, of course, there's a problem with the metric at R equals 2m if you insist that you're going to be working with Schwarzschild coordinates. But now we're well aware of the fact that you can come up, you know, that this problem with the metric is not a problem with the space-time manifold. It's a problem with the coordinate system you're using. And you can easily come up with a coordinate transformation that allows you to, you know, to continue the metric across R equals 2m without any difficulty. And, you know, Finkelstein was one of the first, you know, there was, you know, a succession of people in history who actually could produce non-singular coordinate systems, but people didn't know what to make of that. I mean, not many people actually worried about those issues for a long time, but eventually, you know, some people came to an understanding about this, and that happened in the late 50s, early 60s. So in the book, I spent quite a bit of time talking about, well, I spent some time talking about, you know, popular coordinate systems to describe the Schwarzschild metric across the event horizon. I presume you've studied Kruskal coordinates in your prior education. Yes, no, uncertain. Oh, I wanted to review that a little bit, maybe to demystify them a little bit if I can. So I'll make a quick review of Kruskal coordinates, and then I'll move away and describe some properties of the Schwarzschild black hole. So one major lesson that was learned is that, well, just because you have a coordinate that you call t, that doesn't mean that this corresponds to, you know, time measured by anybody. I mean, we know that at large distances far away from the black hole, t is a meaningful notion of time. R always has this, you know, R is always a good coordinate because the relationship between R and the area of two spheres is guaranteed by the metric, so R is always a good coordinate. What is not guaranteed is the fact that this time coordinate here, t, may not always correspond to some time that anybody can measure, that somebody can measure. So, and that was the problem of, you know, the Schwarzschild metric in its original form. R was preserved as a meaningful coordinate, but there was no guarantee that T would always have a good operational meaning, or a good relationship with something that could actually be measured. And the key to understanding how to continue the metric across R equals 2m was to come up with alternative times. And one thing that's very useful in this whole game is to actually try to construct coordinate systems that are well adapted to the behavior of light rays. And the basic idea behind Kruskal coordinates is to construct the coordinates by making them, by, you know, choosing them or designing them so that it would have, they would give a very simple description of light cones in Schwarzschild spacetime. So let's talk about that. So we've talked a number of times about, you know, radial light rays in Schwarzschild spacetime. So let's review that a little bit. So I'm going to be talking about radial, light rays, which means that I consider displacements along the null direction for which d theta and d phi is equal to zero. So I'll only look at radial displacements. And then, well, we can stare at the metric, and we see very easily that we can factorize the metric, the effective two-dimensional metric that remains when we set this to zero. And we have a minus f in front, and then we have a factorization in terms of dt minus f minus 1 dr and dt plus f minus 1 dr. And if we want to identify the null directions, all we have to do is to either set this to zero, and that will define one null direction, because if this is zero, ds squared is zero, or we set that to zero. And, well, we have either the outgoing null direction or the incoming null direction. And, well, essentially, I'll just introduce coordinates that are adapted to those two null directions. So I'll define the du to be dt minus f minus 1 dr, and that's something that would be constant along one of the two null directions. And dv is going to be, well, dt plus f minus 1 dr. And this is something that I can integrate, so u is going to be t minus the integral of f minus 1 dr. That's what I call r star. And v is going to be equal to t plus r star. And in each case, r star is, well, the integral of 1 over f. And r star, if I eliminate t from the system of equations, r star can be expressed in terms of v and u in this way. And I apologize, I tend to make my v's a little bit round. So if there, you know, there might be cases where I don't distinguish v and u, you know, well enough. But anyway, you can tell me if you see an ambiguity. Okay, so the point is that, well, along one of the null directions, u is going to be constant. Along the other null direction, v is going to be constant. And, well, which is pretty easy. So pretty easy to distinguish. So if u is constant, du is equal to zero. And which means that dt is going to be equal to f minus 1 dr. If we want time to proceed forward, that means that dr has to be positive. And that means that here we're talking about the outgoing light rays. If we set dv equal to 0, then dt has to be minus dr. Dt being positive means that dr has to be negative. Those are the incoming light rays. So we can draw a picture where we can have axes that go at 45 degrees, and this is going to be the v direction. This is going to be, it's the other way around. This is the u direction. This is the v direction. This is you know, a light ray u equal constant, which, as I said, describes an outgoing light ray. It's moving on the right on the diagram. And this is a light ray v equal constant. And that, of course, if I'm going, you know, if time runs upward, this is an incoming light ray. And, you know, if we choose u and v as coordinates, and we can do that, I mean, we can switch from t and r to u and v, for example, and just choose to use our null coordinates as new coordinates in our space-time. It's a little bit unusual because we're not, you know, splitting our coordinates in terms of time and space anymore. We just choose to orient our coordinates along null directions, but that's fine. We can do that. And if we do that, well, we do something which is well adapted to the behavior of light rays, and light in a space-time diagram based on u and v will be guaranteed to move at 45 degrees. We recover all of the familiar properties of Minkowski space-time if we do that. So generally, that's the start of a strategy to build well-behaved coordinates. First of all, we make the coordinates well adapted to something physical like the motion of light rays. We choose to focus on light rays as opposed to, you know, focus on time as measured by observers or, you know, measures of spatial distance. We just accept the fact that we can coordinatize our space-time in terms of the behavior of light rays like that. That's the first step. So first we choose our coordinates so that they correspond to something, physical, like the behavior of light rays. And then we start investigating whether those coordinates retain some of the pathologies of the original coordinate system, and well, in this case, they actually do. And we can see that right away. First of all, let me write down an expression for R star. When I do the integral, given that F has this expression, R star turns out to be R plus 2m log of R over 2m minus 1. Which means that if I want to locate the surface R equals 2m and express that in terms of R star, R equals 2m is mapped into R star equals minus infinity, because at R equals 2m, the argument of the log becomes 0, so the log is pushed all the way back to minus infinity. And therefore, the, in terms of R star, the position of the R equals 2m surface, notice that I'm refraining from using the phrase event horizon for reasons that will become clear. So let's talk about the R equals 2m surface, is described at R star equals minus infinity. And R star equals minus infinity corresponds to the statement that V minus U is equal to minus infinity. And the point is that, well, there are two ways of making that happen. V minus U can go to minus infinity if U goes to plus infinity. And what that means is that in this diagram, the event horizon is all the way up here at infinity. And that's still a problem because, we're aware of the fact that, an observer free-falling, along a radial trajectory in space-time measures a finite time for him to cross the event horizon. So there's no reason why on a space-time diagram the event horizon should be pushed all the way up to infinity. And the fact that here in this coordinate system, the horizon is actually located at U equals plus infinity is really, the inherited pathology of the original coordinate system that corresponds to the fact that, in Schwarzschild coordinates, the coordinate time t required for anybody to reach the event horizon is infinite. It's the same infinity that we're encountering here. So if I'm calculating in terms of coordinate t time as measured in infinity, how much time it takes for anybody to fall through the event horizon, the answer will be infinite. We understand that as being a failure of this time coordinate to describe what happens near the horizon. It's okay at infinity, but it's not okay near the horizon. And the fact that t goes to infinity, while essentially is the same thing, reflects on the fact that u here is forced to infinity, which means that in this space-time diagram, while the horizon is still located at an infinite, value of the u coordinate, and that means that we've gone some way in constructing a meaningful coordinate system by going to light ray type coordinates. But what we haven't yet fixed is the pathology that says that the event horizon is located at an infinite coordinate value. So we're going to have to work a little bit harder to remove the pathology. But there's something else going on here that we'll have to pay some attention to. There's another way of satisfying this requirement. U can go to plus infinity, but it's also possible for V to go to minus infinity. And if you didn't know about it before, you would have the first hint here that it looks as if there are two places where R can equal 2m. One is all the way up here, and that's the event horizon, but there's also the possibility of going all the way down there, and it seems that there might be a different R equals 2m surface down there. And of course, you know better than that, that one is going to be the event horizon, the other one is going to be the past horizon. This is going to be the white hole horizon. This is going to be the black hole horizon. But pretend that we're back in 1955 or something like that. We don't know about these things. We're just exploring the nature of the Schwarzschild spacetime. No one at that point had heard of the two copies of the R equals 2m surface. No one had seen a cross-cool diagram, and therefore there's something a little bit unusual going on here that we need to understand. So I'm going to pursue that. That story as we proceed. Okay. If I re-express the metric in terms of U and V, we see right away And here, I'm going to just add on the angular part of it. So this is du, this is dv. So the metric is in that form. We see right away by looking at ds squared that there's still a problem with the coordinates, because the metric function f is still something that goes to zero at r equals 2m. And that's why we haven't cured the pathology of the coordinate system, because we still have a metric function that does bizarre things as we reach r equals 2m. So what we have to try and do is to see what we can do with, re-labeling our coordinates, or try to come up with a different set of coordinates, a coordinate transformation that will eliminate this pathology. And just to see what might need to be done here, I'll do something a little bit sketchy, but something that will illustrate what's going on, and something that can be turned into a fully precise and exact procedure. Okay, the problem is associated with that, with the fact that f goes to zero at some finite radius r equals 2m. So let's suppose, I don't want to be too precise about this. I'm going to take a function that actually goes to zero at some radius r naught. I won't call it 2m because I want to allow for a little bit more generality. I'll just assume that there's a place in space-time where our function f goes to zero, and if we're close to that place, we can approximate the behavior of the function as something that goes to zero linearly. Well, you may ask, what if it doesn't go to zero linearly? What if it goes to zero quadratically? Well, I won't answer that. That would require a special treatment. But this is what happens for Schwarzschild, clearly the Schwarzschild F. And the Schwarzschild F that we worry about here is something that does go to zero at 2m linearly. That is, there's a Taylor expansion that starts at linear order and then would contain additional terms. And here I won't worry about the additional terms. Okay. Well, suppose that, we're playing with a function like this. The first thing that I would want to do is to relate more precisely, or get more information about the relationship between VU and R star. And what I want to do is to construct R star in this approximate setting. I have it exactly there. One problem that I have here, if I want to play with that with the exact expression, is the fact that I can easily express R star in terms of R, but I cannot invert that. It's a transcendental equation, so I cannot invert that and express R easily in terms of R star. So that's why I'm doing the approximate thing here that is good enough to illustrate what's going on without having to deal with those little complications. So let me just recalculate R star using the approximate form that we have here. R star is the integral of 1 over f. And the integral of 1 over f, well, is going to be 1 over 2 kappa, the integral dr over r minus r naught. So that's good enough for my approximation. And here I'll get a log term. I like to make my argument in the log term dimensionless. So what I'll do is to throw in a factor of kappa on each part here. So I have kappa r over here multiplying kappa r. Okay, so I should have said that kappa is just a constant, and kappa is defined to be half the derivative of the function evaluated at r naught. I forgot to say that. So kappa is just a constant, so I just carry it along for the calculation. And doing the integral, of course, I have a log, so I have 1 over 2 kappa log kappa r minus r naught. And I don't care about constants of integration here. I can set it equal to 0 if I want to. Okay, so r star is the log of, r minus r naught, and this is something that I can invert easily, unlike in the exact situation, and I find that kappa r minus r naught is equal to the exponential of 2 kappa r star. And this, of course, by the definition of u and v, is something that I can re-express as e kappa it's V minus U. And F is twice this, so I have a useful approximate expression for F near the event horizon. And now I've expressed F directly in terms of the two coordinates, V and U. And sure enough, if U goes to infinity, F goes to zero. If V goes to minus infinity, F goes to zero. So we reproduce all the features that we expected to happen. OK, so what does that tell us? Well, let's substitute this inside the df squared and see what we get. If I make the substitution, df squared is going to be minus 2 e to the cap of v multiplying dv times e to the minus cap of u multiplying du. And we have the r squared term, which is now an implicit function of u and v, multiplying d omega squared, the angular part of the line element. And I think here we have a strong hint of what needs to be done. While clearly there's something, I mean, the problem with the coordinates is the fact that we have those exponential factors all over the place. You know, f goes to zero because the exponentials go to zero, and the exponentials go to zero because the coordinate values go to either plus or minus infinity. Well, I was pretty keen on using light rays as a way to anchor my coordinate system. I don't want to lose that. But there's no reason why instead of u, I could not choose a function of u as a substitute for u. And for v, I could choose any function of v as a substitute for v. In other words, perhaps the key to solving the pathologies associated with a coordinate system would be to say, well, instead of u, we're going to use a different coordinate that I'm going to call uppercase u, which is going to be a function of u. And if u is constant on an outgoing light ray, well, capital U is still going to be constant on an outgoing light ray. So I'm not spoiling the idea of anchoring the coordinates to the behavior of light rays. And we're going to be doing the same for v. Which functions to choose? Well, I think we have a pretty strong hint here. What if we chose an exponential relationship and simply said that u is going to be, I'm going to choose a minus sign u here. What if we chose u to be the minus the exponential of minus kappa u? And what if we chose v to be this exponential function? If we did that, that's a very inspired choice, because if we do that, then d uppercase u is going to be equal to kappa, kappa e to the minus kappa u du. And dv is going to be, well, kappa e to the, kappa v dv. And what I see here is precisely, you know, going to be expressed now in terms of d uppercase u and d lowercase d cap, d uppercase v. In other words, after the coordinate transformation, the s squared will become minus 2. There's going to be a kappa squared factor. But other than that, we have du dv. We have an r squared that will now become an implicit function of uppercase u, uppercase v. And we have the angular part to the line element. So what's happened here is that, well, instead of dealing with lowercase u, I'm going to deal with a function of lowercase u. Instead of dealing with lowercase v, I'm going to deal with a function of that. I'm still going to, I mean, the coordinate system is still going to be based on the behavior of light rays. Outgoing light rays are still going to be described by, you know, a u equal constant, but now I mean uppercase u. Incoming light rays are still going to be rays, you know, described by the equation v equal constant, but now it's going to be the uppercase v. But what this calculation reveals here is that now there's no coordinate pathology, because there's no sign that the metric function in front of du dv wants to go to zero or do bad things as I'm about to cross the event horizon. And more than that, while the event horizon, or the surface r equals 2m, while the one that's located at u goes to plus infinity, is now mapped to u equals 0, a perfectly nice finite value for the coordinate. And the other copy, the one that's given by v goes to minus infinity, is mapped again also to v equals 0. And again, that's a perfectly finite coordinate position. And all of the pathologies that were associated with v and u that originated from t being pathological has been removed. And that's a successful coordinate transformation that allows us, you know, to describe all of the Schwarzschild metric, you know, and all of the Schwarzschild manifold. All I have to do now is to try to patch up a little bit, and instead of doing something approximate, I can, you know, go back and do something equal. The approximate calculation identifies the proper strategy and the proper coordinate transformation. And you'll notice one thing is that, well, the approximate strategy was based only on the knowledge that the metric function goes to zero linearly. So it holds for the Schwarzschild horizon, but I don't have to do anything different if I'm dealing with a slightly different metric. For example, if I'm dealing with Schwarzschild de Sitter or Reisner-Nordström or any you know, metric that can be expressed in that form, this general strategy is guaranteed to hold because they all, you know, they all have that property that near a horizon, we have f going to zero linearly in the coordinate difference, in the difference in r. Harvey, you had a question?
Don't you mean uppercase U and V in the bottom equation?
This is, yes, so this is uppercase. And those are Kruskal coordinates. U and V, the uppercase U and V are Kruskal coordinates. Sometimes they're presented in, you know, not in terms of null directions, but in terms of, you know, rotated directions where one goes along time, the other one goes along space. I find them more useful just in their light-like form. I find that more useful, more intuitive, and overall, you know, I'm going to stick with that. Yep?
Since the approximation you use for f is only valid in the event horizon, like the metric that you wrote down, you said is valid
in the time space. Not this metric. This metric is an approximation very close to the event horizon. So what I need to do now is to try to do exactly what I just did approximately. Well, I don't think I'll work through all the details, but in fact, well, it's not all that difficult. So when you want to do this exactly, the only difficulty, it's not a big one, but it's, you know, it's a slight one, is the fact that R is defined implicitly in terms of R star. You cannot write down the explicit function for that. So you sort of have to live with this fact. But other than that, well, it's, you know, the procedure is exactly the same. And this coordinate transformation is not treated as an approximate coordinate transformation. We take that to be the exact coordinate transformation. So for example, in Kruskal coordinates, u times v, well, defined exactly, is going to be minus the exponential of kappa v minus u, which is relatable to r star, again, exactly through that equation over there. And v minus u is 2 r star, so we have 2 kappa r star. And now what I can do is to use the exact expression for r star that I had before. So I get so I have the exponential of 2 kappa r. 2 kappa r plus the log term, 2 kappa that multiplies 2m that multiplies the log term. If you actually calculate kappa for Schwarzschild, you know, according to this definition, which I now take to be exact, kappa for Schwarzschild is 1 over 4m. And that means that we get rid of this factor that becomes numerically equal to 1. And essentially what I get here after simplifying a little bit, I get minus r over 2m minus 1 that multiplies well, e to the r divided by 2m. And that's one part of the coordinate transformation. And then you can, you know, work a little bit harder and express t in terms of u and v. I won't do that here. It's not all that interesting. And this exact version now of the previous expressions that I wrote down will essentially tell us how to construct r equal constant surfaces in a diagram that's based on the uv coordinates. So a Kruskal coordinate, a Kruskal diagram, is a space-time diagram that uses, instead of little u and little v, it uses uppercase U and uppercase V. Uppercase, I always forget which direction is which. So this is uppercase V going in that direction, uppercase U going in that direction. And what this equation tells us is that any surface R equal constant in a Kruskal diagram is going to be represented by the statement U times V is equal to a constant. What's that equation?
Hyperbola.
It's a hyperbola. But more than that, it's a two-branch hyperbola. Because for any, given that the sign is negative here, well, depending on the whether r is smaller or greater than 2m, you know, you have one solution where u and v have, u is positive, v is negative, but you also have the opposite solution where u is negative, v is positive. So bottom line is that surfaces of constant R, there will be two copies of each in the diagram. So R equals 2m, well, of course, R equals 2m is going to be mapped either at u equals 0 or v equals 0. So u equals 0 is this surface over here, and this is one copy of R equals 2m. And v equals 0 gives us the other copy. So we have two distinct null surfaces in this diagram that corresponds to r equals 2m. This will correspond to the future event horizon. This corresponds to the past horizon. This might be called the black hole horizon. This would be called the white hole horizon. So if r is greater than 2m, then the right-hand side is negative. And that means that, well, either u is negative and v is positive, or the other way around. So for example, r equals 3m would be mapped, would be described by this hyperbola over here that corresponds to v being positive and u being negative. So this is r equals 3m, for example. But it has another copy over here and that's where u is positive but v is negative. And it's always the same. R equals 4m would have one copy here, one copy there, and we just go on like this all the way to infinity. R equals m would be another hyperbola that would be in this corner, because if r is smaller than 2m, then the right-hand side is positive, and both u and v are positive, or they're both negative. And this is one copy of r equals m. And this is another copy of r equals m. And finally, r equals 0. Well, r equals 0 is going to be the function uv equals 1. And it's right over here. And usually, we draw the singularity as a nasty looking edgy line like this that tells us that something really bad lives there. So this is r equals 0. And this is another copy of r equals 0. So the Schwarzschild manifold, after going through this exercise, turns out to be quite a bit larger than you or, you know, if you didn't know any better, or people back in the 50s would have thought. I mean, we have two copies of everything. We have a singularity in the future, but we also have one in the past. We have a horizon in the future, but we also have one in the past. And of course, you start questioning whether, you know, all of that is, you know, meaningful or physically realizable. That's the diagram that corresponds to an eternal black hole, a black hole that would have existed for all times, presumably would have emerged out of, you know, the Big Bang already fully formed, and this would be a part of the Big Bang singularity, and the black hole would be there from the from the get-go, and then it would stay there for the entire duration of the universe. While the black holes I know about are not, did not live forever. The black holes that I know about actually formed after a time during gravitational collapse. And if we actually bother to form the black hole through gravitational collapse, we have to remember that the Schwarzschild solution is only relevant outside the collapsing star. Inside the collapsing star, we have matter. We don't have a vacuum solution to the field equations. And we have something that describes, a star that lives for a while happily and then collapses, dynamically collapses to smaller and smaller volumes until all of the matter is concentrated at the singularity. So what we have to put in here is a cutoff that would describe the boundary of the star and the boundary on the surface of the star, the boundary of the vacuum region in Schwarzschild space-time. And we can really see what that would be. Do I have colored chalks? I don't think I do, but anyway. For a very long time, our star would have a static surface, an R equal constant surface, that would be larger, of course, than 2m. So it would follow the word line, or it would follow the curve of a constant R line on the diagram. At some point, the collapse would start, R would start decreasing, and the collapsing star would, proceed through the formation of the event horizon and eventually would collapse down to zero radius. Everything on the right is given by Schwarzschild. Everything on the right, on the left, doesn't belong here because that's the matter inside. The matter inside is described by a very different solution. So all of those lines that I drew before don't belong to the actual diagram for the space-time because everything on the left of this boundary, the star surface over here, is not a part of the Schwarzschild space-time. The Schwarzschild space-time lives outside. What's inside is something else. And this copy of the singularity, this copy of the event horizon, and everything here just don't belong to the space-time. They belong to the extended Schwarzschild manifold as a sort of curious mathematical solution to the Einstein field equations. But if the black hole formed by gravitational collapse, only the stuff on the outside, the event horizon here is real, the singularity here is real, but the extra copies are not part of the physical space-time. All right? Okay. Well, it's still interesting to study the extended Schwarzschild manifold and pretend that there was no collapsing star. And it turns out to be fun to do that. It turns out to be fun to think of the existence of another asymptotic universe over here. It turns out to be fun to think about the possibility of traveling to the other universe. Is that possible? No. Because in order to go like this, you would have to travel faster than light. The diagram guarantees that you have to move within a light cone. That means that this is completely forbidden. All, what you can do, the best you can do is to try to move as quickly as you can. You fall in and then you try to escape from the black hole. Well, there are two possibilities. Either you turn around and try to move out, which will bring you to the singularity, or you go that way and try to go very fast, but you also meet the singularity. So the space-time diagram brings out very clearly the causal nature of the Schwarzschild space-time, and it tells you right away, the light cone connection, the connection between the light cones and the coordinates tell you right away that if you've fallen in, there's really no way you can avoid going into the singularity, because the only way out would be this way or that way, and both are completely impossible. So once you fall in, there's no option but encountering the singularity. And even though those universes tend to be intriguing and sort of fun to think about, well, there's no process by which you could actually travel to them. So if you think of this as a wormhole to another distant part of the universe or another universe, well, as you try to go through the wormhole, it will pinch off and it will form a singularity before you can ever get across. That was the old idea of wormholes before Kip Thorne and others sort of started to engineer that and try to, come up with better wormholes that would actually allow you to travel back and forth if you wished. And you know, that led to the, you know, to the realization that if you wanted that, you had to violate all the energy conditions and all of that stuff. But that's the old wormhole idea, the Einstein-Rosen bridge, the bridge to other universes that pinches off over a short time, too short for you to be able to make it across. I mean, it all comes from an understanding of the extended Schwarzschild manner. Okay, so this picture has become way too busy, and I don't think you can read anything from it anymore. Any questions about any aspects of this? That's a convention. In space-time diagrams, time always goes up. So an observer in a space-time diagram will always move within the light cone. And if the light cone is shaped like a V, then you have to move within the light cone, which means that you move up. That's the time direction. Not T. T is time only far away from the black hole. There's an operational connection between T, the Schwarzschild T coordinate, and time as measured by somebody only if you're safely out from the black hole. Well, in fact, since you asked the question, I can actually say a few more things about that. Let's redraw the Kroswell diagram. So this is V. This is U, this is the singularity, and this is the other singularity. Here I was drawing the curves of constant R. What you wanted to know is where are the curves of constant T. Well, I won't go through the details, but well, in fact, it's pretty easy to see. So if I want to have T, and I want to express T in terms of U and V, what I have to do is to take the sum of U and V, and that gives me T. But in terms of Kroskal coordinates, if I take the exponential of this, then I get the exponential of kappa U plus V, which according to the definitions over here is given by a ratio of capital U and capital V over capital U. So surfaces of constant T are surfaces of constant V over U. And those are straight lines through the origin. So one surface of constant T is this one. And this I might call T equals 0. Another surface of constant T is this one. And this I might call T equals 1. Another one is this one. This I might call T minus 1. Those are the external T equal constant surfaces. We have them that are also internal, like this one. They all have to go through the origin. So out from the black hole, we see that this Kroskal notion of time, which runs upward, let's call it capital T, which would be analogous to what we have before, but now defined in terms of Kroskal coordinates. Kroskal time runs up, and outside from the black hole, well, Kroskal time runs up, and Schwarzschild time runs up as well. So we have pretty good matching notions of time outside the black hole. On this side of the universe, notice that this is T equals minus 1, this is T equals 0, this is equal plus 1. Schwarzschild T runs backward in the other side of the universe if you choose it to run forward here. Does that mean anything? No. I mean, you could switch T here to be minus T there. It wouldn't change the metric. And you would have a time coordinate that runs forward here. But now it would run backward there. Doesn't matter. But it's a property of the T equal constant surfaces that they run in one direction here, and they run in the opposite direction there. Inside the black hole, T runs sideways. This might be T equals, minus 1, 0, plus 1, or maybe it's in the other way around, I'm not quite sure. But the point is that T is something that clearly runs in the sideways direction, it's in the space-like direction. r, sorry, t, so t is clearly a time-like coordinate, a time-like quantity outside the black hole. It's a space-like quantity inside the black hole. R is clearly space-like outside the black hole, but it's clearly time-like inside the black hole, because as I move forward in time, automatically r decreases. There's no choice. R must decrease if I'm inside the black hole, because r is connected to time. R decreasing means that time increases. Sometimes people say this very loosely speaking and say that, you know, I think it's highly criminal and misleading to say something like that. They say that time and space get interchanged on the event horizon. This is completely meaningless. You should never say that. No one should ever say that and get away with it. There should be a fine given to people who say things like that, because what they really should say and what they really mean is that, you know, this time coordinate becomes a failure, complete failure at the event horizon, and there's no way you can connect it up with any operational definition of time across the event horizon. And in fact, you know, we can remember that this is the surface T equals infinity. This is the surface T minus infinity. The range of the Schwarzschild time is limited to this wedge of the Schwarzschild spacetime. You can write down the metric inside the black hole in exactly the same coordinate system, you know, in exactly the same Schwarzschild form. What you'll find inside the black hole, of course, is that F is now negative, so you would write it like this, and you would write it like that. You would look at this metric, and you recognize that, you know, in front of dt there's a plus sign, and you would recognize that this means that t is no longer a time coordinate, it's become a space-like coordinate. And probably what you should do at this stage is to not call tt, but call t something else, which would suggest that you're not dealing with a time coordinate, but, for example, you might as well call it L, because it really has become a space-like character, you know, a space-like positional coordinate. And why not call RT if you're inside the black hole, because it really does come with a minus sign, and we know that, you know, a progression in time inside the black hole corresponds to R decreasing. The point I wanted to make is that, well, suppose that I don't change the name of the coordinate system and I still refer it to T and R. The point I wanted to make is that, you know, I can write down this metric inside the black hole. I can write down a similar form for the metric outside the black hole. R has the same meaning in each metric, but T has different meanings inside each metric. What I mean by that is that the T that lives inside is completely disconnected from the T that lives outside, because the T that lives outside has run its course by the time you reach the event horizon. Therefore, there are two T patches that are involved here. There's the external T patch, there's the internal T patch, and there are different T's. So, you know, to be fully clear about this, if you're going to write the Schwarzschild metric inside the black hole in terms of T and R coordinates, you should probably call the other T, T prime or something like that, to really carefully distinguish it from the T that lives outside, which goes to its full range by the time you cross the event horizon. So, bottom line here is that, you know, if you think about space-time diagrams, if you carefully look at what happens to light rays and light cones in that space-time diagram around, if you look at the behavior of light rays in the Schwarzschild metric, there's certainly no notion that space becomes time and time becomes space. You know, nothing like that happens. Space-time is space-time. It's just that, you know, the names you assign to coordinates tend to, you know, the coordinates tend to have different meanings, but it's only, you know, a feature of the coordinates. It's not a feature of space-time itself. Other questions? So inside the black hole, while it's, let's see, inside the black hole, so if we go back to this notation, inside the black hole, we have a time-dependent metric, so certainly now the metric is no longer static. But the metric doesn't depend on L, the space-like coordinate, and that means that we have a symmetry, we have this translational symmetry in that direction. And that gives me an opportunity to talk about something else. I want to talk about the Killing symmetry of the Schwarzschild solution. I'm going to redraw the Kruskal diagram. So we have V going this way, we have U going this way. We have a singularity up here and a singularity down here. Okay. In Schwarzschild spacetime, I have a Killing vector. The Killing vector, I'll call it T alpha. So I'm changing notation here. So T alpha is no longer the flow vector that we talked about in, you know, in the context of Hamiltonian, GR. T alpha is just something that I'll, you know, use for notation instead of xi slash t alpha. So it's the time-like Killing vector of the Schwarzschild spacetime. And in Schwarzschild coordinates, well, it's simply a vector that's directed along the time direction. So this is a vector that exists everywhere in the extended Schwarzschild manifold. If I express, you know, if I choose a coordinate system which is, you know, which is Schwarzschild, it has this representation, but we have to understand that this is only limited to a piece of the Schwarzschild spacetime at a time. This representation depends on, you know, is limited to a piece of the Schwarzschild manifold, but the Killing vector lives everywhere in the extended Schwarzschild manifold. And this vector, because this is an example of a Killing vector which happens to be hypersurface orthogonal, this Killing vector is everywhere orthogonal to surfaces of constant t. And in a spacetime diagram, if we're going to draw the vectors, we have to be a little bit careful at how we draw them. For this hypersurface, an orthogonal direction is this one, but for that hypersurface, the orthogonal direction is this way. Remember a discussion we had a long time ago about surfaces like this that were becoming closer and closer to the null case. So we had the hypersurfaces going like this, and we had the congruence going like that until they met in the null case. Well, that's what's happening here. As I follow the time equal constant hypersurfaces in this spacetime diagram, they become closer and closer to a null surface. And the direction of that vector also becomes closer and closer to being a null direction. The norm of the Killing vector, the norm of the Killing vector is equal to GTT, which is equal to minus F. And that means that the norm of the vector changes sign on each r equal to m surface, which means that we have a Killing symmetry that goes from being time-like outside the black hole to being space-like inside the black hole. That's our static spacetime going into this spacetime over here that is no longer static, but has become spatially homogeneous. That, you know, at least we have this translational symmetry in the direction of L. So the Killing vector reflects that fact. So the Killing vector is time-like up here. It's still time-like over here, but now the time-like direction becomes closer to the null direction for the reasons I just specified. On the event horizon, the Killing vector becomes a null vector because, you know, its norm goes to zero. Inside the event horizon, inside the black hole, F is negative, the Killing vector becomes a space-like vector. So the Killing symmetry, instead of pointing in the time-like direction, now starts pointing in that direction. It points in this direction on the other copy of the event horizon. It points in this direction in this copy of the universe, and that has to do with the fact that surfaces of a constant T move forward here but backwards here. So the Killing symmetry goes into directions of increasing T everywhere. It goes like that on this copy of r equals 2m. It goes like this in the white hole region of the spacetime. And it goes like this on the final copy of r equals 2m. So it does funny things. It turns around, and well, it's a perfectly smooth continuous vector field everywhere. But something funny is going on right here. At that point, we seem to have a vector field which points either in this direction or that direction or this direction or that direction. So there are two possibilities. Either we have a singularity of the vector field right here, which would correspond to a serious non-smoothness of the Schwarzschild manifold, or something else happens. Can you think of it? The vector field could go to zero here. So it's true that in direction they do this, but if the length of the vector goes to zero at this this point over here, then I don't care whether zero going this way or that way don't match. I mean, zero is zero. Right? And that's the way it goes. So for you know, you can verify by re-expressing the killing vector in terms of Kruskal coordinates that, in fact, the killing vector field goes to zero right here. And it's the only way that, you know, you can accommodate for the vector field pointing in different directions, depending on where you are in the extended Schwarzschild manifold. That surface is called the bifurcation two-sphere. And of course, it's an entirely, you know, fictitious surface. No real black hole formed by gravitational collapse would contain a bifurcation two-sphere, but it turns out to be a remarkably useful tool to have when you try to prove something about black holes. If you try to prove something around, you know, for the Schwarzschild black hole, you know, and you don't care about whether or not it formed by gravitational collapse, you might as well assume that it existed forever. You might as well assume that it possesses a bifurcation two-sphere, and that bifurcation two-sphere, together with a property, you know, that the killing vector is zero there, turns out to buy you an awful lot of power in terms of proving theorems. And that might be something that I'll do later on. And, you know, if you read the literature on black hole physics, you'll find a lot of, you know, take a typical paper by Bob Wald. Bob Wald likes to prove theorems. And one way that Bob Wald can prove a theorem is to rely on this fiction of a bifurcation two-sphere as a way of establishing something which otherwise would be much harder to establish. So the argument that you would use is to say, well, let's compare two black holes, one that's existed forever, one that lived, that was formed by gravitational collapse. So the one that's formed by gravitational collapse doesn't possess a bifurcation two-sphere, but, you know, after everything is settled, the two spacetimes become identical. And therefore, you may as well assume that, you know, your spacetime that was formed by gravitational collapse is extended in the past to this situation as opposed to the actual real situation. And doing this, well, gives you the mathematical fiction of the bifurcation two-sphere, and that allows you to prove a theorem, which would be much harder to prove if you insisted that gravitational collapse had to occur in the past. It's a funny thing, but it works really well. And it gives you a really, really nice shortcut to all sorts of results. OK, let me say a few more things about the Schwarzschild spacetime. And so I've talked about r equals 2m, but now I want to really bring in the notion of event horizon and also the notion of apparent horizon and try to establish a distinction between these two things. The event horizon is a way of characterizing the meaning of r equals 2m in terms of global causality relations between events in spacetime. It's a global characterization of r equals 2m. The idea of an apparent horizon is to do something which does not require global knowledge, but something that can be done based on local information. It's a local characterization of R equals 2m based on the behavior of light. So let me discuss that. It's very important to distinguish them conceptually. And for Schwarzschild spacetime, they happen to be at the same place. For dynamical black holes, they happen to be separate. And I want to illustrate that. I'll go here. So the idea of the event horizon, I think, is familiar. I mean, it's the usual story about light not being able to escape from the black hole interior. So let's redraw the Kronskoul diagram with the singularity. And let's think of a thought experiment where I'm the supervisor, and I live here at a safe distance, so say R equals, 2,000. And I'm sending my favorite graduate student inside the black hole, and I'm instructing her. I say favorite, but then I sort of send you down the black hole, so I'm sort of, sending you conflicting messages here, for sure. Okay, so the poor graduate student is going, is being sent on a mission down the black hole to investigate the properties of extreme gravitational fields. And of course, I want to get a weekly report of what's going on. And after a time, I notice that it takes longer and longer to get my weekly reports. And after a while, I just don't receive anything more because, light is redshifted. I don't see anything coming out of the, those signals, the student is emitting signals at regular intervals in terms of proper time, but the time interval between my reception times become longer and longer. That's the redshift effect. And of course, another aspect of this is that the frequency of the light that's being emitted also appears to be redshifted. So after a while, my receiver, becomes useless. The wavelength has become so long that it falls outside the receiving band of my receiver, so I just don't get anything. And of course, the poor student is still trying to send messages. They just don't go anywhere. They never come out of the black hole. And that is seen very clearly from the structure of the diagram. Once you're inside the black hole, try as you might, a light ray will never be able to reach the internal world, the external world, because this light ray, along with everything else, only has one option, and is to move along decreasing R and eventually meet the singularity. There's no way you can ever send a signal that would do something like that. That would mean propagation backwards in time or propagation, along space-like trajectories. You just cannot do that. So the notion that you have this one-way boundary from which, you can never re-escape, you have a one-way surface, you have a one-way travel within the black hole, and you have no possibility of ever escaping, signals, light rays can never escape from the black hole interior. All of those ideas are associated with the event horizon nature of R equals 2m. And there are much fancier ways of describing this in terms of domain of outer communications and things like that. But essentially, that's the idea, that once you've crossed this boundary, and it's a global boundary, there's no way of ever making your way out if you use purely causal signals. There's no obstacle in receiving signals until the moment where you hit the singularity. So it's a boundary as far as singing things out, but everything still falls in without any problem. So an observer can receive messages, until the time where everything, where the observer has actually fallen into the singularity. Okay, so that's the notion of the event horizon. And of course, for Schwarzschild, that, the surface that has that property is located at R equals 2m. There's another, so that's a global characterization of R equals 2m in terms of whether or not you can communicate with the outside. The apparent horizon is something different. Now, I really want to insist on the fact that one is a local characterization while the other one is a global characterization. Global here because you have to look everywhere outside and convince yourself that no signal could ever make it there originating from that black hole interior. It's really a statement about the overall, completely, the causal nature of the entire space-time for infinite times, everywhere. So there's really something very global and very importantly global about the definition of the event horizon. The apparent horizon is a way of giving up on the global aspects and try to focus on what happens locally because it's much easier to discuss what happens locally. So here's the diagram again. Here's the singularity. And what I want to do is to slice this with a space-like surface. In technical terms, this is a Cauchy surface. And each point on this surface, because we suppressed the number of dimensions here, each point on that surface represents a two-sphere. So this is a two-sphere. This is a two-sphere inside the black hole. This is a two-sphere right at the boundary. I want to do a thought experiment where I'm going to sit on that two-surface, and I'm going to emit light either toward the exterior or toward the interior of that surface. Outgoing light rays outside the black hole propagate outward. Incoming, if I shoot light rays, on the external face of the surface, I get this. If I shoot them on the internal face, they move inward. So one class of light rays move out, the other class of light rays move in. And that's what you would expect. You shine light outwards, it moves out. You shine light inwards, it moves in. That's normal behavior. That's exactly what happens outside the black hole because gravity is not that strong. While inside the black hole, it's different. You shine light inwards, it moves in. You shine light outwards, it also moves in. Because each light ray is proceeding toward the singularity, so that means that each light ray has a decreasing R, and that's precisely what I mean by moving in or moving out. Here we have abnormal behavior. We have evidence of extremely strong gravity because a light that is being shone outward still chooses to move in. That's the extreme gravity of a black hole. Two surfaces that have this behavior are called trapped surfaces. Light is being trapped there. Light refuses to move out. That's a trapped surface. As you look at what happens as you go from this point to that point, obviously there's a transition that occurs here where we have marginally trapped surfaces. And it's marginally trapped because here, okay, so here incoming, so light rays that are shone inward go inward as they always do. But the ones that you shine outward are right on the event horizon of the black hole. R is equal to 2m everywhere on the surface, which means that those light rays actually don't go anywhere. They don't move in. They also don't move out. It's the marginal situation in between. And that's why I call this a marginally trapped surface. Everywhere inside here where we have trapped surfaces is called the trapped region of the black hole. The boundary of the trapped region, which consists of a marginally trapped surface, is the apparent horizon of the black hole. So the marginally trapped surface, which is the same, there are some technical aspects where those equalities are not necessarily equalities all the time, but anyway, let's not worry about this. The marginally trapped surface is the boundary of the trapped region. And that is called the apparent horizon. Which is really a different way of talking about R equals 2m in terms of local behavior of light. One way of finding the apparent horizon in the space-time, once you've selected your hypersurface, is to look at the congruence of outgoing light rays, calculate the expansion, and see where it's zero. Because here, the expansion is clearly positive. The light rays are expanding out. Here, the expansion is clearly negative, because even though you're shining outward, the light rays move in regardless. This is a situation where theta out is negative, and that essentially is a defining property for a trapped surface. Theta in is always negative. Theta out is negative for a trapped surface. Theta out would be positive for, you know, a normal two-surface, which is not trapped. In the marginal case, the expansion of the outgoing light rays, of a congruence of outgoing light rays, which is being, that originates from a close two-surface like this, is zero. And that's a way of finding locally the presence of an apparent horizon. Those are very important definitions of, properties of black holes. The event horizon has a global, aspect that the apparent horizon doesn't have here. We don't care whether, we don't care about the entire properties of the entire space-time. We really care only about the properties of what lives on this hypersurface. And the local nature of this means that, for example, when in numerical simulations people go look for horizons, they'll look for apparent horizons as opposed to looking for event horizons. Now, here I'm talking about R equals 2m all along. I'm just, giving you a fancy treatment of R equals 2m. Is there really a need to distinguish the event horizon from the apparent horizon? And the answer is yes. Because in general situations, when you allow for dynamical processes to take place, the surfaces will be different. And in the last 10 minutes, what I would like to do is to draw some pictures and illustrate that. You have a question?
How would you define the event horizon, the apparent horizon, as the boundary?
Well, the event horizon is defined, so there are fancier mathematical definitions, but essentially it's the boundary of the surface from which you can have external communication. So there's the region outside the black hole is called the domain of outer communications. This is the region from which you can reach future non-infinity, or you can reach infinity by a light signal. The boundary of this is the event horizon, and inside the boundary you have a region from which you cannot reach infinity through a light signal. And that's the interior of the black hole. The boundary of those two regions is defined to be the event horizon. So I didn't want to be precise here, but you can find something a bit more precise in my book. And if you want full precision, go see Wald. He gives you the fancy mathematical treatment. Okay, so I want to talk about this difference between apparent horizons and event horizons. I'll do two examples. And I just want to draw a picture. The picture would be based on some coordinate system, but it's a coordinate system that's a little bit different from Kruskal. What I want to draw is something that does represent a black hole formed by a gravitational collapse. And I want to describe it as follows. So time, let me do the diagram first, and then I'll explain what time is doing. It's probably a diagram you've seen before, but I really like it. So I'm going to try to restore one of the lost spherical dimensions from this diagram. This is a circle, but it's really a two-sphere. And it's the surface of a star that's just about to collapse. And before it collapses, it lives on and evolves in time for a while. But then it collapses, which means that the surface is shrinking, and it's going to continue to shrink until it shrinks all the way down to R equals zero, at which point we have a singularity. So that's a picture for gravitational collapse. This is the center of the star. And let's imagine that we're sending light rays outward from the center. Earlier on, when gravity is weak, light rays propagate more or less around 45 degrees. So here I'm not using crustal coordinates. Light rays are not going to be at 45 degrees unless gravity is weak. It's a different representation, which I could make precise if you force me to, but I wish not to in this case. So a light ray going off from the center early on when gravity is still weak more or less goes around at 45 degrees. A light ray emitted very late in the collapse is captured by the gravitational field of the collapsing star, and that light ray turns around and merges into the singularity. There's a marginal light ray that, if you emit it at exactly the right time, will be focused by the infalling, the infalling matter. And as the light ray emerges from the collapsing star, it does not this, it does not that, but it does the marginal case in between. That is, it just stays there. It doesn't fall in, it doesn't go out, it just hovers. And that's the event horizon. The event horizon, R equals 2m, is generated by light rays that are emitted at just the right time, so that by the time they make their way out of the matter outside of the collapsing star, they happens to be stationary. So all of those light rays are being focused by the infalling matter. That's the focusing theorem. This light ray is focused very lightly. This one is focused very strongly. This one is just in between, so that when it emerges from the collapsing star, it's stationary, and it defines the event horizon. On this Kruskal diagram, which has become unrecognizable, while I'm talking about this light ray over here that comes out of the surface of the collapsing star and stays on the event horizon. And the other light ray, the one that's in, is the one that comes out of the surface and eventually encounters the singularity. And then there's the other one that goes all the way to infinity. Someone had a question? You had a question?
So at this region, so basically there is a shell of light surrounding the
dark. It's a thought experiment where I assume that, I'm here in the center and I'm shining a flashlight or shining a laser, and I'm mapping the behavior of light rays. Or I could think of a collapsing star that's still shining somehow, and this is the light that leaves the surface.
As a surface, R equal 2m, there is a shell of light.
Not necessarily. I mean, the surface could be completely dark, and I could avoid being in the center shining a laser, in which case this photon doesn't actually exist. Mm-hmm. But the point is that R equals 2m can be thought of as something that's generated by these escaping photons. Okay, so what am I trying to say with all this? Well, the event horizon is this null surface right here. And if I restore the other dimension, it's this entire thing that starts at one point when gravity is strong enough for the horizon to form. And then all points over here are generated by light rays. And what I have here is a null surface that is being generated from one point at the center and then moves out with the speed of light. And then those photons, those light rays, are captured by the gravitational field and they stop moving out after a while. This is the event horizon. Where's the apparent horizon? Well, the apparent horizon is a little bit more subtle, because if I look at light rays coming out from the center, those light rays, for a while, are still moving out. And they'll move out from the center for a little while until they're captured and focused by the infalling matter. So the behavior of light rays inside is universal. It's going to be moving out for a while until it's captured and starts moving back. And in fact, I didn't draw it very well here, but you can actually convince yourself that that the point at which they start turning around is, you know, hugging the surface of the collapsing star pretty well, like so. So that all the so before they cross this boundary over here, and its copy over there, the light rays are actually moving out until they start moving in, having been focused by the collapsing star, having been captured by the gravitational field outside the collapsing star. We have expanding outgoing photons here. We have converging outgoing photons over here. So the transition between theta being positive and negative is taking place right here at the boundary. And that is the, so the apparent horizon then is the union of this segment to r equals 2m. Well, maybe we don't care too much about this distinction. I mean, maybe this is really fine print. So that was the first example. And if you allow me, I'll just take maybe two, 3 more minutes. And that means 5, of course, to do something a little bit more advanced that really shows an important distinction between apparent and event horizons. It's this story, except that I'm adding an extra ingredient to it. Let's suppose that in our space-time, we have gravitational collapse of something, and that happens first. And after a while, we release a shell of material around the black hole that will then collapse later and merge with the existing black hole. So first we collapse a star, then we collapse at some delayed time a shell of matter around that that will then collapse and fall into the black hole, you know, in a spherically symmetric fashion. I want to describe all of that. And I'll need a fairly long diagram here. So this is the central singularity. This is the initial collapsing star. This is the center. And this is the initial guess for where the event horizon is. But it's only an initial guess, because this is my expectation based on only knowledge about the collapsing star. At some later time, at my choosing, I decide to collapse the collapsing shell. And the collapsing shell was over here somehow, somewhere. And then at some point, it just falls in. And there's a big shell of collapsing matter that does something like that. And I suppose I can repeat it on the other side, but I think I won't do that. Well, there's r equals 2m, and there's r equals 2m, right? There's the mass of only the star, and there's the mass of the star plus the shell. The final black hole presumably contains the mass of everything. So there's an r equals 2m that corresponds to only the star, and there's r equals 2m that corresponds to everything. So I'll distinguish little m from uppercase M. This is r equals 2m that contains the entire mass. This is r equals 2m that contains only the small mass. Which one is the event horizon? The whole thing, right? The black hole contains the whole mass. The larger r equals 2m must be where the event horizon is. This event horizon had to be formed at the moment where light rays emitted from the center still thought that they had the option to go all the way out to infinity. You know, they didn't know any better. They didn't know about the collapsing shell. So here they are. They've escaped the gravitational pull of the collapsing star. They're on their way out to infinity. But then, they encountered a collapsing shell. They are focused by the material inside the collapsing shell. That's the focusing theorem again. And by the time that this light ray emerges on the other side of the shell, it has been focused in just the right amount so that it emerges stationary at r equals 2 larger m. the event horizon is a null surface that ends up being stationary after everything has happened. And it was emitted before this, you know, initial guess for the event horizon, which turns out to be a false guess for the event horizon. So what's the meaning of this? Well, first of all, one lesson is that in order to locate the event horizon, we have to make sure that everything that could happen in the space-time has happened. We can only decide on the position of the event horizon when everything has happened, so we can actually identify the final mass of the final collapsing, you know, bodies, everything together at the end. You can, you know, when everything has happened that will ever happen in the space-time, then you can go and identify the final R equals 2m surface, and then you trace it backwards in time. You let it do its thing, you know, and get, you know, focused and so on, and then you can identify at which point in the past the horizon formed. The horizon is something that you decide after the fact. You can only, you know, you have to trace it backwards in time. If you try to guess when it's formed, you would always get it wrong, unless you were extremely lucky. Because either, you know, if you guess that it came here, then you'll find that this, you know, after everything has happened, this light ray, in fact, continues to escape to infinity, while this one, well, it was escaping for a while, but then it got focused a little bit too much, and eventually it's going to reconverge toward the singularity. So to know for sure that the event horizon formed here, well, the only practical strategy is that you wait forever, you go locate R equals 2m, where m is the total mass of the space-time, and you trace the horizon backwards in time. That's why it's never done in numerical relativity, because, you know, it's too expensive to do that. You have to evolve forever and then locate the event horizon like that. Where's the apparent horizon? Well, to locate the apparent horizon, all I have to do is to figure out whether my light rays are expanding or converging. And the story that I had over here repeats itself over here. So if I look at light rays that go off from the center, well, as they're emerging from the collapsing star, they'll always be, you know, expanding for a little while before they're pulled back in by the strong gravity. So I wish I had some different color, which I don't think I do. But in any case, a piece of the apparent horizon is going to be the same little boundary that I drew before that, you know, that hugs the surface of the collapsing star before it merges with the place that I call R equals 2 little m. So at this point, we still have light rays emitted here that for a while will be stationary, and for a while will think that they're defining the event horizon. This is the boundary where we have light rays turning from converging to diverging. But at this point, the light rays are focused by this material. So what I should have done here, what I should have done really, is to indicate that the expanding light, that the stationary light ray over here will get focused by the infalling material. And in fact, they'll start doing that. They'll get refocused. They thought they were on their way and defining the event horizon, but then something happens that converges those light rays, and they turn into being stationary to being, converging. And eventually, they will meet with the singularity. So where's the apparent horizon? Well, the apparent horizon starts here. It hugs the surface. It goes along this piece of, you know, this stationary light ray. But then it cannot stay here because those light rays now, because of the extra focusing that takes place here, become converging. The apparent horizon will have to go and match this other stationary situation. They will have to merge with that one. So it does this. And then it moves up like that. The apparent horizon is very different from the event horizon. They agree when we have a stationary piece of the space-time. But when you have dynamical situations taking place, like here or here, the apparent horizon does rather surprising things, in order to, you know, really, you know, satisfy its requirements. So basically what happens is that you have this light ray over here that moves out until it crosses this boundary, which is the event horizon, at which point there's enough focusing that's happened to force the light ray to reconverge on the other side. That's what the apparent horizon is. It's that boundary when you go from diverging to converging. And it has to happen here because that's where the light rays turn around. Bottom line, the event horizon is here. The apparent horizon does this crazy stuff. And there are very different surfaces in space-time. And the distinction is important. If numerically you go hunting for apparent horizons, well, you might actually be way off from where the event horizon actually is. And there's no way to avoid that. You can only know for sure where the event horizon is if you trace it backwards in time after everything is settled down. If you don't want to do that and you want to search locally for apparent horizons, well, I mean, you will never know how, you know, off you are compared with the actual position of the event horizon. And more than that, sometimes you'll find a surface which is actually time-like. Typically, so this is a space-like segment of a hypersurface. This is null. This is also space-like. So the apparent horizon that you'll end up generating, according to its definition, is something that can be null if the piece of that space-time is stationary, like with what we have here and here. But typically, when you have dynamical situations, you'll find that the apparent horizon is not defining a time-like surface nor a null surface. It's actually defining a piece of a space-like surface. This is all part of how it's defined. And, by just looking at Schwarzschild, you'll never suspect that the apparent horizon is a rather curious but interesting, surface. But when you think about it like this, you find that, well, it has to be that if it's going to satisfy its basic definition. So that was my lesson on the distinction between the event horizon and the apparent horizon. In the book, I have a more, mathematical treatment of this based on some solution to the Einstein field equations that describes a dynamical process involving accretion onto a black hole. In the next homework assignment that will come probably next week, I'll actually assign you a real problem where, given a real dynamical space-time that I made up for the purposes of the problem, you'll actually have to map out the position of the event horizon, the position of the apparent horizon, and you'll see very clearly, the distinction and which is which, and you'll see it in a fully quantitative context instead of just in a hand-wavy, pictorial context, as I just did here. Well, I'm sorry I went really long, but that's all I have to say for today. Any questions?